You're no longer me.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, September 21st, 2020, and this is the Town of Curry Beach normal council meeting. I would like to start with an invocation and a pledge of allegiance. Commissioner Ellen, would you lead us, please?
Yes. Please join me in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for every seat that has been filled here today. For each mind and heart that fills the presence of this room, we thank you. Only you truly know what we are setting out to accomplish today. We have an idea, a vision, hints, and daily instructions. We have talents, abilities, and time to work. However, only you can see in perfect detail the end of every beginning. Every project, every season, every life. Nothing is ever in vain, or even mistakes and missteps are used for good. Your righteousness transcends all our efforts and understanding. Forgive us for our pride, the pride that puffs us up, and the pride that threatens to unqualify us. Strengthen our confidence in who you have made us to be. Set us free from comparison in order to work together efficiently. Bless this meeting today, all those present, as well as the lives of those we will encounter afterwards. Ready us to make every moment count. Amen.
Amen. Stand for Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, let's look through the consent agenda. Are there any questions on the consent agenda? If not, then we will look for a motion to approve it.
Do you have something to add, I believe, to the consent agenda?
The resignation of Donald Bowen from the pedestrian.
Oh, that's right. Add the resignation of Donald Bowman from the pedestrian committee to the consent agenda. Okay. We will add that as item
3.8.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I make a motion to approve the consent agenda as amended.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Adoption of the agenda. Gentlemen, I would like to remove 10.1 on garbage at rentals. John could not be here. John Batson could not be here this evening. I told him we would take that off. That was a discussion about rental garbage, and we will pick that up probably at the next meeting.
Good, Jimmy, and I look forward to it.
So, any comments on the agenda beyond the reduction?
Motion that we accept the agenda as amended by you, Mayor.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. So we have the agenda set, and we are now ready to begin. Are there any public comments? Anybody signed up for public comments? Okay. I'm sorry?
Open it to the callers.
You need to open it to the callers.
Yeah, we can do that. Do we have any public comment from the callers? How many are on?
13.
Just 13. Okay. Well, moving on then. We'll move into presentations. And that is Zachary Manfredi.
Yep.
All right. Cape Fear Moving Forward 2045 Metropolitan Transportation Plan. Welcome to Curie Beach.
Thank you.
And for those out in the audience, you can go to the Town of Curie Beach website and look at the agenda if you want to see the presentation on your home computer.
All right, so I want to thank everybody for coming today and letting us present our plan and thank the board for letting us present. Hello, my name is Zachary Manfredi, and I'm an Associate Transportation Planner with the WMPO, and I'll be sharing with you our Cape Fear Moving Forward 2045 Metropolitan Transportation Plan. So presentation overview. I'm going to talk about what the WMPO is, what we do, what the MTP is, what that does, how we develop the plan, and then how you can support the plan. About the Wilmington Urban Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. I'll probably be referring to that as the WMPO for the rest of the presentation. So WMPOs are federally required planning organizations for all areas greater than 50,000 people, and we were formed in 1978. Now we have a population of 280,000 covering 494 square miles. And that includes parts of Brunswick, Pender, and New Hanover County. And we have a 13-member board that guides our policies and direction. Do you mind if I take this off?
That would be my guess. You'll be more comfortable, so will we.
Yeah, thank you. So some of the responsibilities of the WMPO include we're federally required to provide regional transportation planning that is continuing, cooperative, and comprehensive. So that's what we call like the three C's. And the big things we do are the MTP, which is what I'm presenting, the UPWP, which is our annual work plan, and then prioritization for the STIP, which I'll get into a little bit more, but that's basically the funding that NCDOT has for us. And then coordinating board objectives and activities every year. So the MCP is a federally required plan, and it has a 20-year scope, and it's multimodal and considers regional demographic and land use policies. The big things are public involvement, being fiscally constrained, and then being the basis for that MTP, the TIP and STIP money. So being fiscally constrained, this means that we have to predict how much money we're expected to have, and we can only include projects that will fit within that budget. So it's kind of like that first part of budgeting out your projects. So this is an overview of the plan process starting in January 2018 and ending fall 2020. This includes public involvement, stakeholder feedback, and then prioritization of projects. So this is like the first part where we get all of the projects from people responding to our public output. All right, so occasionally there's new requirements and considerations. Recently, the FAST Act, which is Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, has included additional planning factors and intercity transit. On top of that, we like to have our own considerations to take into account the current transportation environment. And these things include a performance-based approach, innovative technologies, like you can see here's the driverless vehicles coming up. Resiliency is, I'm pretty sure we've included it every year, but we really like to focus on it just because we get keep getting hit with these storms. That's a picture of 40 right there, which I'm sure a lot of you have seen. And then environmental justice, making sure everybody's voice is heard during the planning process. So this is what I was talking about earlier. This is the first step is public participation. And we had a 4-month window, I think, where we gathered results. And we had two big tools we used. One was a survey, which we had 2,000 responses roughly. And then we had a map. That's newer. I don't think it's been done in previous ones, where people would be sent a link and you could put projects that you think would be beneficial. And then from there, people that go on the link, they can vote on projects that were suggested. So we had 500 unique projects and then 4,500 comments on those projects. This is like the first step of us. This is kind of getting all the projects in one big ball for us to work with. So from there, we had the modal elements development. So we have 6 multimodal subcommittees created, and these are all experts in the region. So we worked with ILM, with aviation, we worked with WAVE, with public transportation, the DOT, and we tasked them with looking at this huge ball of projects and creating criteria to score them, and then also policies. And what we ended up with is a ranked project list for each mode. So you have a rank, you have big funding or all the projects, and then you narrow down the prioritization of them, and then the funding or the cost, and then we're looking at funding. So we had a consultant look at each mode and explore the previous funding trends, and then they try to project forward for the next 20 years what they expect us to have. And this is part of that fiscal constraint. We can't just go in and say we're going to have 100 new roads and 10 bridges. You have to be kind of realistic with it. This is our constraint. We ended up with $3.8 billion in capital funding, $5.3 billion in operations and maintenance. And it's always surprising the amount of the operations and maintenance costs, because it's not usually what's popular to talk about, but it's a huge expense. So this is when it all really starts to happen. So you've got the big project list, prioritize the list, funding amount, and then you start figuring out what you can afford. So there you have your prioritized list. Step 2, you're going to take your funding, and you're basically just going to keep buying projects from the most important to the least prioritized until you run out of money for your 20-year band. And then what we did from there was look at alternative funding. Example I like to give is the Wilmington Parks Bond Project. So you're like, that happened before, so maybe we'll have a bond in the future. You can add a few more projects. We also looked into other alternative funding sources. So there's a gap of $7 billion, meaning we're $7 billion short of funding all of our projects. So the board looked at other alternative funding sources, and they selected tolling of the Cape Fear Crossing, allowing for the forecasted toll revenues to be utilized for fiscally constraining a portion of the project in the plan. That was required just because that was like a monstrosity of a project, and the board felt it was really important to include. And the only way we could fiscally constrain it is if we said that there was potential for a toll. And NCDOT is pretty strict about what they allow you to toll. So it has to be a new facility and So a lot of different things. So that was what they decided they wanted to do. So we had all of our big projects prioritized, funding predicted. We spent our budget. So that's all for the projects. We also look at TDM strategies and then TSMO strategies. So TDM strategies is, it's transportation demand management. So instead of adding facilities, you're trying to reduce the amount of people on the road. And this is things such as convincing companies to have let people work from home, or carpool, manpool, riding transit. So I think the pandemic is a great example of this, because if you go out at 8 o'clock, the traffic is usually, it's not nowhere near as bad as it used to be most days. So that's what that involves mostly. And then, so you have another option is your TSMO. Basically it's operations. So instead of widening a 3 mile strip of lane, if you have a 2 lane road, you can maybe look at where your turns are, because everybody's experienced this. We have 2 lanes going, it's pretty busy, and you have one person making a left and backs everybody up. So instead of widening the whole road, you add a turn lane. So we looked at places where we can do those smaller projects that are more operationally efficient and cost effective. So we wrapped all of those good ideas and funding and transportation demand management and operations into our project, and we presented it to the public again. And this was, so we had two open houses previous, before all the restrictions, and then we had three virtual open houses. And we got 113 comments. So not quite what we got in the beginning, but we addressed all the comments that people had and passed it on to our board. So our final plan, we have 82 bicycle and pedestrian projects, 91 public transportation projects, 79 roadway projects, 28 aviation, 7 freight rail, and 10 ferry projects. And then your role in supporting the plan. So one of the big things is when you're looking at your plans or doing reviews and stuff, is just give our plan a glance and see what it has in it. A great example is that if you're gonna have a bicycle and pedestrian plan developed, you can easily use our framework to build upon. Look at the projects that were proposed in our plan, the policies that were proposed, and like doing these types of plans, it's always 100% easier to start with something like already in hand and then you kind of modify it than just kind of building stuff from the ground up. So that's a great way that you can use the plan. Supporting our initiatives, like Bike to Work Week, those types of things. And then participating in future efforts for our plan. And if you have any questions, you can ask me or email that.
I do have a few questions.
All right.
Who sets priority?
So we have a CAC, which is the Citizens Advisory Committee, and that's developed specifically for the development of this plan, and they kind of set the direction for the plan.
Are those local politicians? Are they local businessmen? Or who? What makes up that group?
The CAC is a mix, I think.
So are you asking who sets priorities for our
yes.
organization? So
yes.
our board sets the priorities and the direction of the organization. The Citizen Advisory Committee was comprised of citizens, one from appointed by each of our board members. So there was a citizen from Curie Beach who was on the Citizen Advisory Committee. They guided the direction of development of the plan and worked closely with the modal subject, with the modal subcommittees comprised of the subject matter experts. But ultimately, every decision that was made on the plan went to our technical coordinating committee, which is comprised of staff from our member jurisdictions, and then ultimately to the board for a final vote.
Okay. It was curiosity to me now that is the bridge part of this, or is that something separate?
The bridge.
The new bridge.
The new bridge.
The Cape Fear Crossing.
Yes.
So that was identified as still being a priority in our region at some point in the future. We recognize that over $1 billion project, we're going to have to identify some type of alternative funding source in the future. It's just not feasible with the type of funding we receive currently in our region. That said, in order for the board to conclude at least a portion of that project as being fiscally constrained, they voted to include the revenues from tolling that project. And that's a very high level analysis that was done a couple of years ago, estimated that at about $158 million during the life of this plan.
Okay.
So it's that amount that is considered fiscally constrained within this plan.
The only reason I bring that up basically is because without the Southern Bridge, you have probably 50,000 people who really have only one road out of here. And if there's an emergency, it's usually, it'll have to be a fast boat east, so let's hope it's not a hurricane, right? So, in any case, I understand, do any of the rest of you have questions for this team? I mean, they do a great job with trying to take the spaghetti and make a plan out of it. Questions? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will move into committee business. And the first agenda item on committee business is Board of Adjustments. And it's the interview of applicants for the alternate position. Now, the alternate position is a position that is on standby for an opening that would occur on the Board of Adjustments. The Board of Adjustments is our... Yes, sir.
It's my understanding about the rules of procedure in front of me that the alternate for BOA actually sits in on the meeting where there's an empty chair, not to fill a vacancy, but to have as full a board as possible during the quasi-judicial hearing.
I agree with that statement, Jim. My thought there is that I don't believe they're voting.
They would vote if someone was absent.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they vote if somebody's absent.
So it would be different from P&Z then?
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's quasi-judicial. Right. Okay. So I believe we have two gentlemen for consideration. One is Kurt Bartley. Mr. Kurt Bartley, how are you?
Good.
Would you join the... yep. There are a variety of questions that you answered. Gentlemen, did you have a chance to read through his input, and do you have any questions for him?
Yeah, so just the major one, right? What's the purpose, what's the role that you're asking the council to put you in? What does the Board of Adjustments do? And why do you think you're the right person for that job?
Well, the Board of Adjustments sits in the quasi-judicial hearing, and they take information when somebody appeals zoning before the town, and they sit there and they determine, basically, they listen to both sides, they listen to what the county ordinance, the zoning ordinance, and then they make a decision based on what's the best for the town. I don't know if y'all know exactly who I am, but I used to be the police chief at Carolina Beach, and I spent 30 years in law enforcement, so I know the judicial part. And the last couple of years that I was on with the town, I sat on what we call a technical review committee, which basically you have zoning officers and you have planning zone, building, fire, police, and all that. So I was a part of all that, so I sort of have some idea of how the zoning works, at least in Carolina Beach, and I would love to learn what Curry Beach is. I've lived here since 2008. I grew up on the island. My father and mother were, well, my father was in the military, and we've been here since 69. So I've seen the first condo built all the way to today. So.
I was going to ask the question, I think he kind of answered it, but I was going to ask the question, that's an important committee. And it's a committee that has to make decisions that have usually some intensive impacts on the individuals who you may be telling no or potentially yes. And I was going to say, how do you deal with conflict? But if you were a police chief, I guess you know how to deal with conflict.
Also, while I was with the town, I sat on a condemnation hearing for the town one time. And we had to tell them, we had to tear your buildings down. I'm used to telling people no and yes.
John, any questions?
No, pardon.
Alan?
No, David, yes.
Joseph?
One question.
How many exceptions has Curry Beach made over the years? Four to the Board of Adjustments?
That actually made it?
Yeah.
As far as I know, like, in only Carolina, two actually got approved. The other two got, like, I wish Andy was still here. The other two sort of lasted long enough that no one made them go away.
And Carolina Beach is over 300, made over 300,
yeah.
Right?
That's so, a lot more, yeah.
Definitely some drastic numbers being in Curry Beach.
Yeah, but this is my home, and this is where, you know, I'd like to be a part of the board and have some input in the town.
Awesome number there, Joseph. Awesome number. Good point. No further questions for Mr. Bartley?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Bartley. And unless you want to make any closing statement or something.
I'm just glad to be a part of the town.
Thank you. And thank you for your service. Mr. Pomeroy.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So, same question for me.
Yeah,
what's the purpose of the Board of Adjustment?
A little bit on the back of it where you talk about the board.
I know, I see it. That's what I was asking,
and,
right?
And I got confused. I had just read an article about New Hanover County doing the reassessment, which the values come into effect on January 1st of 2021.
That's
so
right.
I was thinking more of valuation assessments, but I understand the role of the Board of Adjustment is to handle an individual or corporation or LLCs when they have an appeal for some type of variance, whether
right.
it's a building variance or some type of construction variance. I'm probably, see, I don't know what the four cases were in Curry Beach, but my guess would be there probably was something to do with maybe a setback or an irregular shaped property that they couldn't get the house where they needed to put it, so they asked for a variance.
That's right.
Those type of things.
And so what's your thoughts on variances just in general? Right, I saw your resume, very impressive, but what's your thoughts on, because you've been in Curry Beach for 5 years now?
We've owned property here in Curry for five. And we
five, okay, good, I can do that.
Beach for yep. years before that.
And so what's your thoughts on just variances in general and looking around Curry Beach?
I think you're always going to have a need to handle a variance because something unique is going to come up that's not written in the law or the code or some type of regulation. So there's always going to be a gray area. And I think you need that ability to handle somebody's request for a variance because some of them are valid. So I think you'll have that. Now I think on the island here, we're pretty much, you know, we're already defined, we're already surveyed, we already got GIS, so we're pretty much, like, if they only have four cases, we're pretty static. So maybe most of those irregularities have been handled.
Now, I was going to ask you the same question, but I see you were in the military, and you had, you were involved in law enforcement and military too, is what it looks like to me.
I spent a few years with NCIS, yes.
Right.
Officer agent, I was a reserve intel officer, but we were officer agents with NCIS.
And quite a few positions of importance through 04, 05. And then, of course, quite a bit of work in the business sector.
Yeah, I did 34 years, Navy active in reserve time, and I also spent 34 years, not they were simultaneous, the reserve board. Mm-hmm. I spent 34 years with George Pacific and, you know, various levels of management.
Okay. So you don't have any trouble telling somebody no, whether it be council or whether it be the, because you've got to tell somebody no if they're at the BO, if they're at the Board of Adjustments. It's because there's conflict and somebody's going to be voted wrong.
Yes, if somebody can't prove their case, and the burden is on that person that's asked for that variance to prove their case.
Okay.
And then they're at the table beside you with Jack Mackles the following weekend after you tell them no.
That, yeah, that may happen. That may happen.
Okay. Any questions? John?
I have no further.
Alan?
No further questions.
We have two very appealing candidates. We can only pick one, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. There are other positions that the town has if you don't seem to be the individual voted into this particular spot. So I would tell you, your desire to serve on what is a difficult committee, the willingness to take on the responsibilities of the seriousness of many of the things that come to that committee makes me feel good about the type of people we do have in this town. We have a lot of great volunteers, and we're about to get one more. And from that point, we will hopefully we can keep the other individual interested. So, any comments?
It's not an easy decision.
No, it's not an easy decision. These gentlemen deserve an answer, though. Discussion points.
Well, I mean, I've been pretty vocal about Board of Adjustments in the past. Mm-hmm. So I'll just let you guys know my view. Unlike many small towns, Curry Beach has been very successful by very rigidly enforcing our planning and zoning. The variances that have been granted in the past, like I said, I think there may be four. They're all predate me on council and predate Jim on council. Our Board of Adjustments, as far as I know, I'm trying to remember now, and Jim helped me, but I don't think Board of Adjustments has ever recommended a variance on council since before I got on and you got on in 2001.
Unless it was one of the swimming pools on the ocean side of the...
Those didn't go through Board of Adjustments, though. The council did that action. I think Board of Adjustments would tell us not to, probably. Honestly. And so, I mean, one, I think you're both very well qualified for the issue. The mayor highlighted the point about you have to be able to sit in fair judgment and then give people bad news. And I think either one of you could well do that. I think for me, just the issue for me is that while variances may be worthwhile in Curry Beach, the bias towards the Board of Adjustment for me is to supporting the town and planning and zoning and the ordinances that we have put in place. And so I'm looking for a person that's biased towards there are no variances, no good variances, honestly. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I'm saying that's how I'm biased. So just from that, I would say for me personally, I'm leaning more towards Mr. Bartley just because of the discussion we had, the short discussion. Like I said, I'm fine with either one of them, but if you're asking for a lean-in, that's the way I lean it.
All right.
There you go.
John?
It's almost a toss-up. I didn't know either gentleman personally. They carried themselves both well. Answered questions. I think that either one do a good job at Board of Adjustment. As David said, been here longer than that, of course. It is that board does not have a lot of activity. But I would move toward Mr. Bartley also.
I'm sorry, John.
I would lean toward Mr. Bartley
Okay. Alan?
Well, thank you, Bart. I've already stated I think we have a tough decision to make tonight. I'm just not there yet.
How about you, Joe?
Well, in tight situations, I always go to longevity in the town, because I think the longer you lived here, the more you've seen and experienced being in a coastal community, so I'll give it to Mr. Bartle.
Okay, it sounds like this is heading for Mr. Bartlett to be the alternate. I would support that as well. Though I would tell you, Mr. Pomeroy, we have committees that meet far more often than the Board of Adjustments. And I would look forward to seeing you as a candidate on some of the other committees, potentially planning and zoning or other areas as well. So this round, I believe, is going to go to Mr. Bartley. And do I have any nays against that? All in favor?
I'll make a motion that we appoint Kurt Bartley as the alternate to the Board of Adjustments.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
And Mr. Pomeroy, appreciate your naval officer as well.
So thank you. I know you're retired as well.
Exactly. So.
And truly.
Still up, brother.
I'd be looking for you as a candidate in other areas.
We'll get your phone number. We're going to call. They weren't real busy, so I wanted to kind of ease in, but I did want to get more active.
Yeah. Well, you're not off the hook.
There you go.
So, Mr. Bartlett, thank you for coming forward, and you have our support. And with any luck, you won't have to have very many meetings.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Next item, Planning and Zoning Commission. Chairman Galbraith.
Yes, thank you. Again, the first item, we have a number of things that we'll probably need to go through, but our first item is look at the recommendation from Planning and Zoning for Mr. James Dugan as the alternate member for Planning and Zoning. We have several very good candidates, but it was a unanimous vote of the PNZ to pass on the recommendation for Mr. James Dugan.
Any questions for Mr. Dugan? We all happen to know Mr. Dugan very well. He usually sits on this side of this counter. So, do I have a motion to accept him as alternate?
I make a motion to accept Mr. James Dugan as the alternate for Planning and Zoning.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Welcome back, Jim.
Good to be
back. Careful what you ask for.
Good choice, Mr. Galbraith.
Thank you. All right. Second item. This is something that has been festering, if you will, for the last several months. We had a resident, and John, is John here?
No, John's not here.
That had a temporary swimming pool in the front yard, and this encroached on not only the setback, but also on the right-of-way for the town. We asked them to move it off the town property, and they moved it back a little bit. But what they did is they proposed a text amendment that would allow certain temporary structures, pool, actually the official text amendment that they proposed recommended or allowed the pool, trampoline, and gymnastic equipment to be in the setbacks. So it turns out that looking at this, that both the gymnastic equipment or the swing set as well as the trampoline do not require a building permit, so that wouldn't be covered anyway, but the pool would require a building permit according to John. So we had a discussion in Planning and Zoning regarding the proposed text amendment. We recommend that the text amendment that was presented to us not be approved. However, we did have a discussion, and we will consider looking at simply the backyard setback as a possibility. We haven't made a decision, but this is going to be our next agenda, next meeting's agenda item is to look at the possibility of a swimming pool, a temporary swimming pool in the rear setback. But certainly we voted against either having it in the front setback and the side setback. So what you have before you is a proposal to not approve the text amendment. However, because this is a zoning, there's actually a formality, and Mr. Eldridge will jump in if I'm incorrect on this, but there's a formality that we have to go through. One is that we do have a consistency statement for our disapproval that you should have before you. But because this also is a zoning requirement, you technically actually have to have a public hearing on this and have then, after the public hearing, a formal vote to either accept the text amendment, because we're just simply providing a recommendation. But you actually have to have a formal vote. So what you have before you is our consistency statement for the disapproval of the proposed text amendment, which would allow it in front and years, and also through all districts too. That was another issue that was a concern. It would be applied to every district within Curie Beach. So what you have before you is the consistency statement for non-approval, the actual recommendation for non-approval, but you will have to set this technically for a public hearing also. Is that correct, Mr. Eldridge?
That's 100% correct. For Chapter 15 text amendments, PCC reviews and recommends, Council considers and acts. Council has a public hearing before it acts. So that is correct. So what the order of business, and you'll also adopt your own consistency statement when you do act. I think Mr. Goldberg mentioned that PZC's consistency statement and recommendation is not binding on council, of course. So the order, the only order of business tonight is to fix a date for the public hearing on this proposed Chapter 15 text amendment.
Okay. So let's talk about setting a public hearing. I've already heard from the department heads as to their position relative to safety, etc., and emergency equipment, and Public Works has weighed in. So we certainly will we certainly will do what we need to do.
What time is the council meeting on the 19th of October?
It'll be at 6.
Six.
You haven't scheduled an emergency meeting at this time, but you may in the future.
I thought we did.
You did.
We continued
the week
before. Oh, we said it's the second, right?
I see. Yeah.
Make a motion. We set the public hearing for this issue at 5:30 on October 19th, just prior to our town council meeting.
Okay, we have the motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay.
Okay. The next item is a project that we've been working on probably for close to a year right now, and this is what is called the lighting ordinance, or addressing the issue of light trespass. And what I did is, a couple of days ago, after we had our P&Z meeting and we took our vote on this, is I put together, and you should have this in your package, I believe, a background for this, rather than try to explain it all at one time, give you a little heads up in terms of the history of this in the background. But we've had over, actually, a number of years, various people come in. We've had probably more recently, including several members of the P&Z who are, you know, concerned about light trespass. And you know, basically, people have come in and said that their neighbors, or you know, have a searchlight that shines in the window and they can't enjoy it, and so forth. So that kind of got us interested in it, and we looked at a number of other ordinances. Many towns, including many coastal towns and small family towns and tourist type of towns, in fact, large cities also do have light ordinances. We did extensive field work. We looked at many of those. We probably looked at about 50 different light ordinances at one time or another. We did extensive field work. I think everybody on P&Z drove around the town at night and looked at different lighting situations. When anybody would come in and complain, a resident would complain, we'd all go out there and maps and kind of look at that situation. Mr. Babson also certainly has driven around and looked at this particular issue also. As I mentioned, we've reviewed many other lighting ordinances. There's also what's called the Illuminating Engineering Society and the International Dark Sky Associations. They support ordinances related to lighting. They have a model ordinance. And so we started actually with the model ordinance, but that's about 55 pages long. It's way too long, way too complicated, and everything like that. So, but there are some good standards in there that we did look at. Just to let you know that we did review that, certainly that document also. We did talk to several city managers of communities, actually two city managers of communities that did have lighting ordinances to get their take on it. So we not only just looked at the verbiage, but also talked to a couple of people. And then we also extensively revised. So we started with a fairly complicated one, but the feeling of P&Z based upon the past directive of the council is that for Curie Beach, it should be relatively simple, easy to understand. So we kind of shortened this down. And so what you have before you is an abbreviated, and this is what we recommend. Very quickly, some considerations when we developed this and our revision is it had to be appropriate for Curie Beach, so not a very complicated one, and they can get very complicated. It had to be congruent with other similar communities, such as beach communities. Simple and short, I just mentioned that. Objective measures, I believe one or two of the council members said that you wanted to make sure that there were objective measures on this rather than what's called a reasonable ban. And then Mr. Eldridge supports that under current rules and things like that, there should be objective measures. It has to be complaint triggered. So this is not something where John's going to go out and start with his light meter run around. It has to be complaint driven. And also consideration of the sea turtle nesting issues right there. We did, what you have here is I cut and paste something out of the Blue, the International Dark Sky Association recommendation. What they do is they look at the different type communities. They identify different zones associated with that. And I just went ahead and copied their zone, lighting zone one and lighting zone two. And you can see that based upon that almost everything in Curie Beach has to do with lighting zone one. So, we're basically a lighting zone one type of category. And again, you can read the description right here. We may have a few things that are lighting zone two, more specifically right in the downtown community might be technically the lighting zone two. And as you can see right underneath that, these are their lighting trespass recommendations associated with lighting zones. We're not lighting zone zero, that's more rural areas. Lighting zone one and lighting zone two. I should point out that this is also being recommended as part of our nuisance ordinance. So, we have a number of different nuisances identified. So this is just simply go into the nuisance ordinance category. So it's not a land use plan type of issue, but it's a nuisance. So what you have before you is really a relatively simple proposal. It just deals with residential. We decided not to look at commercial to commercial. We certainly have a special use permit process where, if you remember when we had the golf cart parking rental thing, we were concerned about light trespass coming out of that because they were going to have a 24-hour light, and we put that as part of the special use permit and that they couldn't have it at certain times if they're not open and there couldn't be leakage. So in the commercial areas, this does not address commercial to commercial. There is a component that addresses commercial leakage into the neighboring residential properties. But we have that as a higher element, type of standard right there. So basically what you have with a number of different exemptions, which are standard exemptions here, you basically have a one paragraph regulation. Having to do with the 0.1 foot candle, the 0.2 foot candle, residential to residential, 0.1 foot candle, commercial to residential, 0.2 foot candle. Again, as you can see, that's the recommended level here. And that's what many, many towns had. We started off with a discussion of shielding and all the different types of shielding. If you go into the dark sky model ordinances, they literally have 30 pages on shielding. We didn't want to do that, so talking to actually two of the city managers, they said there's a very simple solution, which is what they recommend. It's very, very simple. Just simply say that you can't see the light or the source of the light. And they say, well, if it's 40 watts, everybody's going to have porch lights, everybody's going to have lights on the garage and stuff like that. So this allows that. 40 watts or less would be fine. That's not going to invade or trespass light. But, if you have a big searchlight with 150 watts in it, you simply can't see the light source. So the idea here is you can light up your property all you want. Just don't let it trespass to the neighboring property above what we're recommending. So what you have before you is the recommendation after about a year's worth of work, kind of sidetracked a little bit by the COVID-19 issue, but about a year's worth of work and a lot of background to recommend having this. And, you know, again, Mr. Eldridge has been key in terms of drafting this, so do you want to come up and say anything?
No, I think you've done a great job. I'll be glad to answer any questions. Again, Chairman Bright, it boils down to a, I think the exemptions cover most situations from seasonal lighting to porch lighting. The prohibitions speak for themselves, the main one being if you don't meet the general standards set forth under section E1. And of course, turtle nests are included in that. We went from six or seven general standards and four or five specific lighting standards to simply going with the abbreviated model of having E1 speak for all of them. And it's a great fit. It's easy to do. And the other point I would make is I believe it's a two-year period to come into compliance unless there is a complaint that results in a finding and conclusion that the lighting is prohibited, and at that point, John steps in with his normal code enforcement procedures. We put this in nuisance like we did with graffiti to maximize abating the nuisance, and for any cost associated with that, including attorney's fees if you have to go to court, to be taxed against the property owner who was early notified and did not abate. And if they don't reduce those costs, then we establish a lien for the same on the property. So it's very simple, very effective, easy to swallow ordinance, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
In the prohibited lighting, which is paragraph D, number four, lights which blink, flash, move, revolve, flicker, change intensity, or change color. On the front and back of my helmet when I ride my bike, and on the handlebar in front and back, I bust every one of those. They flicker, they change color, they change, one, it changes intensity, it goes from a low red to a high. They don't revolve, but they do move and flash and blink.
I would say that the lighting on your bike helmet does not fit under any of the applicable definitions of exterior lighting, facade lighting, landscape lighting. Let's just call those warning signals or traffic signals, and I don't think they fit into the spirit of the ordinance.
Good. I would not expect our police department to stop me, because I'm trying to be safe and trying to get people to notice that I'm out there on the road. By purely reading that sentence, My bicycle lights bust all of this.
No, and again, I think that Mr. Eldridge pointed out that that's not an exterior light. Okay. You know, and again, I have a bicycle and I have the same, exactly the same.
I do too. I have one of those helmets as well.
And then seasonal lighting, I assume means like the holiday lights, because all those are the same issue, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to make sure I understood.
Should point out very quickly too, we also have a sign ordinance, so we didn't address, because issues related to the sign and lighting of the sign are already covered under the sign ordinance.
And seasonal lighting.
And that's LZ2 actually.
Yes.
Right. I do have one question for you. Jim, lighting used in emergency situation or conditions, does that cover security lights that flick on with motion?
I would not. To me, the interpretation of that is for first responders, police, and fire. I don't think somebody's security light falls in under an emergency situation or condition.
So when you have these two massive high beam lights that pop on in front of your home when somebody pulls in or drives up, they are no longer acceptable.
They are acceptable if they don't leak across the property line and if the lighting source is not visible from a residential area. Standard E1. Security lighting is defined as exterior lighting used for illuminating walkways, roadways, and equipment. So the definition takes it out of
super. If they didn't go off, let's say for example, they came home and then they didn't go off or something like that.
Which is probably the major complaint we have. Our security lights.
That's right. That's why I brought it up. I wouldn't know how to handle it.
My daughter can't sleep in her bedroom because the neighbor across the way, the pond basically has a security light and it stays on all night. And
it
really
have
illuminates probably 15 houses.
And you have palm trees that blow back and forth and put the lights on to go off, put the lights on.
People can have all the security. I've got security lights in the front and back of my house. What I will have to do if this ordinance passes, I'm going to have to tilt them down and make sure they point to my property.
Make sure they're pointing on your property, not out from your property.
That's exactly what I'm going to have to do.
But these are good questions because it shows how flexible the one standard is. It's one size fits all.
I read every bit of it, and I'm fine with it. I was just trying to figure out where does that, because that is the most significant complaint that I hear.
Some of the ordinances do, again, we try to keep it as simple as possible. And I think that's very important, and as we've heard that from council, that you want to have simple ordinances that people understand. You can certainly get into it. I've seen some ordinances which will have how long the timer can be set, 10 seconds, 20 seconds. We didn't want to get into that. We just simply say, you can have security lights. Just make sure that you don't trespass those lights into your neighbor's property. That's all. Okay. And again, this does not cover commercial properties. So commercial properties are not covered under this, other than if there's leakage to the neighboring residential property.
So two other questions. One, so how did you come up with the 0.1 foot candles? Just for instance, was that a standard?
Many of the ordinances had exactly that one, and that is again the recommendation from the Dark Sky too. So that's why I included these charts here. So you can see that under, I'm not sure if you have a color version of this, but the very last chart, which is a cut and paste out of the Dark Sky model ordinance for lighting zone 1, the recommendation is leakage should not be more than 0.1 foot candles. So, and we saw that many of the ordinances that are out there use the standards from the Dark Sky.
We actually had a stricter standard in earlier drafts, and we relaxed that quite a bit.
Yeah, well, that's what I was asking. And number two, how are we going to direct and educate people on measuring that? Because light's additive. So if they have their lights on and they go out there, they got to realize they got to turn all their property lights off first, so they're only getting their neighbor's trespass light, right? So that was one that can really make people mad, but when they have to realize that, light's additive, if all your lights are on, that's not how you measure it. You got to turn all your stuff off for the building inspector.
And again, the measurements would be by, I guess, citizens could get involved.
Well, it'd be by the building inspector before we do anything. I understand, but John's got to understand that too.
We wanted to make sure, again, talking to a couple of city managers have had to implement these things. I mean, the implementation is an issue. I think everybody recognizes that because inevitably the complaints are going to be at midnight. So we wanted to build in, which is what a couple of the city managers recommended, and I did see this in several of the ordinances. We saw this also, is that, just simply have a 40-watt bulb. You can put a 40-watt bulb into it, and that satisfies the ordinance. Where you start to get the problems are when you start to get up, bigger than the 60 watts or 100 watts, and that type of thing. Also one other thing is that if you notice right here, we have a standard. I think it was 5 feet beyond the property line.
Yep.
Yeah.
Some of them had 10 feet, some of them at the property line, some had standing 10 feet above the property line. I mean, all sorts of weird things. So this, again, just seemed to be the basic standard that we saw out there. But you're actually right. Light meters tend to be fairly directive. I did purchase a light meter myself before. I did this and kind of walk around. And you can actually download a light meter on your phone, which, by the way, is not very accurate. I did check.
I think the chairman's volunteering to
go on midnight.
He's got the midnight shift.
Don't wear a white shirt when you go out, by the way.
And light meters aren't that expensive, so John said there's not any problem purchasing a light meter. I think it's about $200 or $300 for a light one. They are very directive. To get kind of circular, circle back to your question, they're very directive, so you can just capture the light from one particular light source.
Okay. Any other questions on this, or shall we move on? Or I guess we need a vote to accept this.
Does it need a public hearing or not?
No, this does not need a public
hearing. It's not a 15.
It's not a part of zoning.
Right.
It's just an ordinance.
And The building inspector's not here, but I'm assuming he's in favor
he's
of enforcing this?
Yeah. He certainly has been involved in the development of this since the beginning.
It's been a very collaborative effort at
good.
ECC. Good.
Well, Joseph, you're the liaison. Where do you stand?
I'm fine with it. I make a motion we approve the light trespass nuisance ordinance.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Good work. Thank you, Joe.
Well, thank you all very much. We put a lot of work into it.
Yes, P&Z did a great job on this, Craig. Good job.
Thank you.
Yep.
Good
job. Okay. Next up is the pedestrian committee. Mo? Thanks for your work, Mo. I see you've been very busy.
Well, I'm so excited to be here in person since our committee was formed at the beginning of the year, and this is the very first time I've been able to talk to you directly.
Right.
It's awesome. And this crew is so fantastic. The people that we chose. We've had a professional walk audit training, and we've gone out and we've started that, and we're gaining a lot of information about needs in the town. And I know that we want to take baby steps. And so the first thing that we saw a need and thought this would be a very smart way to follow up on it was what we're calling the spot lane connector. And that is the lot where the
it's called getting right to the point.
And they are directed to go down to, if they're following the East Coast Greenway, they would go down Mackerel to Fort Fisher and then head south on Fort Fisher if they're on bicycles and they're going that way. But what we have found is, whether on a bicycle or walking, and especially a lot of families, they actually walk on Spot Lane to where it dead ends, and then they squeeze through the snow fence and they walk on the town lot where the northwest corner of Settlers Lane is, and then they head south on Settlers Lane. And so because that's where the people are going already, we figured that would be a smart place to start by making it more feasible for them. And we thought, okay, this could be the spot lane connector. And we would like to see the town open it up so they could get through there, either walking or on bicycles, no motorized vehicles at all. And that's the other thing we're thinking. We would want to have some kind of a bollard or a post or something to prevent, make it open wide enough for people to get through, but no cars. And
or golf carts.
No golf carts. No, nothing motorized. And when it comes to e-bikes, that's a whole nother discussion. But a very simple, elementary way, low cost, and you know, make it safer to get the walkers and the bicycles off of Fort Fisher, at least that section of our town. Once they get on Settlers, they can just head right down Settlers, cross K, take the neighborhoods all the way down to E. And Steve Schumann, one of our committee members, made the PowerPoint, and I can figure out how to do it. There. This shows the bird's eye view. Apparently, there's not an issue with Public Works as far as people walking on that property.
Did you say there was a snow fence at the end of Spot Lane right now?
Yes.
Huh.
Jim and you did a real good job after they cleaned out the ditch and put up the fence.
Yeah.
And brought it over. And there's enough room for a person to squeeze between a light pole and the fence.
Jimmy, is there any problem with being close to the well house there?
No.
Not with
really
walk traffic.
Yeah. To be
honest. As long as people don't park cars there or drop cars there, it's fine. They can't picnic there.
So since our purpose states that we strive to assist the town council in the realistic planning, funding, development, and implementation of facilities and programs that will result in the increased safety and use of bicycle and pedestrian travel, we felt that this is really a good place to start, and we would like the council to approve the usage of the Spot Lane connector for bicycle and pedestrian travel.
Okay. Originally, I thought you were trying to define the entire, but you're actually just looking for this access point.
Yes.
At this point. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. If we were going to define the entire trail, I thought, well, we ought to do that with a little bit of public hearing. But if we're just looking for this access point right here, and it is safer.
It's already being used.
You're the liaison here. Do you have any points to make, Alan?
I agree 100%. I met with some of the committee members up there when we looked at it, and it keeps young kids, it gives young families the ability to get to the Carolina Beach Greenway without getting on the Alabama Mackerel in Alabama that typically has a lot of traffic on it. So I think it'd be a...
So you think it's a good idea?
Yeah, it's a nice step to start forward.
Okay. John, you're a bike rider. What do you think?
I support it. I've used that before. I didn't know there was a snow fence, but I don't use it very much because I'm on the road. But a couple of times when I have gone up, you know, from here down, up and around, you know, I'll get on the greenway and come back home. I'll come down through there, and there used to be like a chain or a rope across that I had to stop, lift the rope up, push my bike in, and get back on and go. So I support this. It'll work. I won't use it very much because it's not for exercise type stuff. But I do support it.
I would assume that this would mean some type of pavement.
Initially, that's not what they put in there.
No.
They said long term.
Yeah, well, right now we want the council to approve the connector.
Okay.
And then we will look at what the cost of a permanent trail would be that we would bring to the council at probably the budget next year.
Okay.
Yeah, right now it's just opening it up.
Just opening up for people walking in there, yeah.
And
it's
gravel and sand.
Yeah.
I mean, even on my small... tires.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to ride it with the road bike through there, but a cruise bike, you can ride through there easy.
Yeah.
Any points?
No, David? Jimmy's good, I'm good. We just got to define what kind of bollards, so we put them.
Yeah, and I think
the bollards can do that working with the pedestrian committee.
Okay. I got some ideas.
Would there be a, like a fence on both sides of the walkway where people put straight back?
That's, we haven't delved into those details yet, but yes, we, something that you would approve of too.
I sent a picture of the way the Island Greenway has it.
And I didn't.
Yeah.
I forgot to include that.
Okay, well, and it's a great idea because it just has the fence and then it has the bollard in the middle and people go through the, and we're only thinking of doing that on the spot lane side.
That's right, yeah. You don't need it on the other part.
Yeah,
it's a road.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do we need consensus or a motion? But I'm supportive.
I'll make a motion that we accept the proposal of the bicycle pedestrian committee.
I'll add to it.
All right.
Make a motion that we accept the proposal and have the bike committee work with Public Works to properly execute the vision.
I'll second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Good suggestion, Mo.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Thank the committee.
Keeps it off of Matsu property, too.
Yeah. Community center? Nikki, anything?
No.
Still not meeting, are we?
I don't think they're going to meet until next year.
Okay. Marketing committee? No, no inputs? Shoreline access? I don't know if Dennis is on or has anything to add.
Sounds like someone.
Historical Preservation Committee. Chairman Galbraith.
Thank you. Just again, a little bit of the history here. If you remember, now about a year ago, maybe about 7 months ago or so, we submitted our initial report to establish a historic preservation district to the state. They came back with a number of comments. The two primary comments were that we needed a better architectural narrative to describe actually the downtown, what's unique about the downtown area that could then be translated into design standards later on, as well as we were missing a good quality map. So we had talked to you last year about this, and I believe that John had proposed about $5,000 into his account, basically, that could be used for this. So we were at a point now where we got proposals. We got three proposals from firms to assist us on those two components. We are selecting for a couple of different reasons. One is that two of the proposals put well above $5,000. Recommending that you approve the contract that should be before you. That's a process that has to go through. You have to approve the contract for SWCA for their architectural design services, in particular to assist us with the architectural narrative. And I think everybody recognizes that the architectural narrative will not be based so much on the materials, because there have been so many different materials used because of the hurricanes and replacement and so forth, much, much more having to do with the scale of the B1 district and the design characteristics. But the architectural narrative will capture that. And they also agreed to do the required map for $3,000. That gives us a little bit of money to play with as we start to get into the design standard components of it. So once we get those two components, they told us that it'd be about a 3-week. So that would kind of work within our time frame that we would hope to have a proposal for establishing the historic district back to the council in probably your December meeting.
Okay.
Mayor, I have some comments as well. May I?
Certainly, Councilor.
One of the considerations to beef up the designation report, which is what we're talking about, again, your Historical Preservation Commission comes up with a designation report. We may or may not submit it back to the state for further feedback, but eventually it all comes back to you as a text amendment to Chapter 15 to designate this historical overlay district, point one. Point two, the feedback from the state was very useful in terms of making sure that the designation report was sufficient and comprehensive enough to withstand hypothetical or potential legal challenges down the road should a developer not like a decision that the HPC issues following a quasi-judicial hearing, that they don't get the certificate of appropriateness. And in that respect, the state's feedback was very useful, and this particular vendor, SWCA, has been very cooperative and seems to have the qualifications to do exactly that. Indeed, in terms of cooperation, they will produce, the original option, they gave us two options, we're going with option one. The original cost for option one was $2,500. They're going to turn around and include a very nice map for $500 more without taking anything away from the option. So I agree with the chairman that that's the way to go, and it would be a stitch in time that would save nine for the town to go ahead and do that. I want to make a couple of comments to you and to staff about the proposed contract, which is the services agreement that follows the proposal. I have reviewed it. It's surprisingly fair and well balanced. I very rarely see a first draft of a contract that have mutuality in it, and this one does. No consequential damages for either party. Mutual indemnification. It's always unilateral when I come across it. No provisions for alternative dispute resolution, but I think that that's not necessary in this case. I focus more on insurance. There'd probably be some on-site work done by the vendor adjacent to right-of-way, so I wanted to make sure the coverage was there and the limits were there, and they are, and they're sufficient, and they're good. Bless you. I would add, and this is a note that I wish staff would take, whoever's going to go back to the vendor, I would add a section 8.3 to the services agreement requiring the vendor to deliver to the town clerk certificate of insurance showing the coverage. In this case, I don't think it's necessary, particularly since they're giving us a good price. We don't want to bump up that price. I don't think it's necessary to add the town as an additional named insured. I don't see a lot of risk associated with this, but we do want to make sure that they're adequately covered. My thanks to Mr. Oliver. Section 9.5 needs to be revised to change the governing law from Arizona to North Carolina. Thanks again, Mr. Oliver, for that insight.
I'll review a couple of
And then finally, I note that on the services agreement, there are some fill-in-the-blank provisions. Some of it's contact information, but I think the important part, so that we can get back on schedule following the pandemic, is the start date blank, which I would encourage if council adopts a resolution authorizing the mayor to execute this agreement. I would like that start date to commence this week, with a notice to proceed by email to the vendor, because option one also provides for a three-week term deadline, and I would want that part of the services agreement to reflect that three-week option, because HPC is developing some timelines based on the vendor's representation that as soon as they get the notice to proceed, they can turn it around in 3 weeks.
Yeah. We need to finish this because then we have to roll it into the land use plan.
That's correct.
We have some urgency that's beginning to build as we look 12, 18 months down the road.
So, if any
barring any further pandemic issues.
Any questions we got, we'll address.
Okay. So the request is for $3,000 to.
I've got a couple, Mr. Mayor. SWCA is the architectural.
No, I thought they were, but they're, if you look at April Montgomery's qualifications, which are in the agenda packet, she's a planner. She's got a master's degree in that, and it looks like her references all reflect that. Yeah. But she's not architectural, so there are no specific procurement requirements.
And there are no field visits?
I think there will be field visits.
The proposal says no field visits. They may do a field visit. The proposal one, which is within our budget, would require us to provide pictures and all that sort of thing. So, but you know, once you start getting field visits, you bump well above the $5,000 limit.
Well, but how do they do the job if they don't come to town and actually lay eyes on our town?
I'm guessing that they probably will come to town. But remember, this is primarily going to be a scale. When I talk about architectural narrative, there are several different standards that can be used for designation of a historic district. One would be materials, one would be the age, you know, that sort of thing. We do have the age of, you know, almost all the buildings within the district, not almost all, but we have many buildings that are over 50 years old, which is standard. But I think everybody recognizes the unique characteristics of what our town is about has to do with scale and design. It's not architectural, it's not materials. And so the architectural narrative, if you will, and that's simply what it's called, it's just simply called an architectural narrative, is going to be more based upon scale rather than looking at the actual materials within there. And so the general feeling is that we can provide whatever pictures. Certainly if they want to come and visit, I'm guessing they probably will, to be honest, but that's not required as proposal one. All the visits would bump this up close to $10,000 to have somebody come visit. I don't know why it goes up so high, but as soon as you see a visit in there, you're owed $7,500 and $10,000
for this. Mr. Galbraith is correct. The lexicon is that architectural narrative that is actually very...
Three readings for the sidewalk parking tonight.
I'm sorry, mute your phone, please.
But there's very little architecture involved in this particular instance. We're not coming in under the historic district statutes under that criteria. The standards we are coming in under are association, feeling, atmosphere, which are statutory terms, but albeit very fuzzy.
And it happened to do a lot with scale design.
Yes, that's correct.
Mr. Elbert made it very clear that the insurance, they would be working potentially in the right of way, but why is that an issue? They're not going to be coming to town.
I'm like the chairman. I can't see how they won't come to town at least once, but I just feel like you should cover that possibility.
I think we need to kind of clarify that.
They're not required to come to town, but I'm guessing they probably will come down and visit.
We can get that clarified.
Well, proposal one does not require them to come to town. I mean, that's clear. But I think what Mr. Eldridge is saying is that if they do come to town, we should make sure that there's insurance coverage for that.
I'm afraid that if we bring it up to them, that we may get a modified price. The price may go up. I think we're very fortunate to get the map for an additional $500.
And we are trying, we're very sensitive about the cost issues, obviously, these days. And so we're trying to live within that original budget of $5,000.
I understand that, but I'm cautious that we're getting what we're paying for. And if they don't come to town, how do we know? I just don't see how they can do the job without coming to town. That's just my point.
We did have that discussion, obviously, you know, about coming to town versus not coming to town and the price associated with it. We plan on providing, if they're not going to come to town, and once the council approves this, we'll be in conversation with them, obviously. We may suggest that they come to town, but if they don't want to come to town, what I will probably do is walk around and videotape very closely, just like what we did with the state. We actually did
more than enough for the state.
And provide a lot of really good information that way. We did that with the state too. And that, because they didn't come either. The state didn't even come down. You know, they usually come down, but they realized that it was such an effective way of looking at the community that they may actually establish in the future that they don't actually visit when they, you know, designate.
They were prohibited from traveling.
They were prohibited from traveling, so this is the first time that they did it as a walk around.
I think Councilman Oliver brings up a good point that we can follow up with. I could see us going back to the vendor and saying, good news, council has approved the contract, but there are some legitimate questions about how you're going to do this without coming down. Can you reassure us about that? But I also agree with Chairman Galbraith. I participated in a Zoom walk around that he conducted, and you could see everything. Matter of fact, I I was chagrined that I didn't recommend to the chairman that he record that, because it was a perfect walk around and you could see everything. So that may be one way of doing it. But we can follow up with the vendor to rest assured. But I'm based on the qualifications and the material that accompanied the proposal that's in your agenda packet, and the fact that she has, this April Montgomery has done some historic preservation commission type work before, I'm comfortable that we're going to get what we need.
One last question, and I think we should move on with getting to the point of this, and that is, did they happen to tell us what other communities they looked at in this type of regard?
Again, the agenda pack of materials have some references to what her work has been, but she didn't say exactly where she was going.
We interviewed three people, and I think all of them had references of what they had done.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure that she has some experience. I don't have
okay. I just that. Hadn't seen them. I did see her output and things like that. So
there was, all of them had experience with historic districts when they applied to talk to them.
Okay. So
page 71 of 170.
71?
Mm-hmm. Starting on page 70 is the qualification. Well, starting on page 69 is April's qualification.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But on 71, you have some specific historic property evaluations that this vendor has done.
Well, yes. We didn't get that.
Project descriptions.
Yeah, we didn't get that.
Well, we can get that to council, right?
Yeah.
We just very quickly, the old proposal before we went back and asked for the additional map has all that information in it, but because we went back and got the additional, evidently what was provided to you was simply the new proposal. But she does have the qualifications.
Quite a few excellent examples
yes.
here. I happen to have the printout, so
because
I write all over
old
these things
works.
And I can't do
see
it.
See old school work?
Yeah, see? Old school way works. Nebraska State Historical Society, Historic Context, which is what we're looking for. New Mexico Department of Transportation, Mitigation, Bridge Replacement, Community Historic Property Survey in Colorado, Nebraska, California, Texas. Yeah, this is no...
And again, I just should point out that she's not writing the report. The report is already written. We had an intern from UNCW, the historic district,
right.
We actually have the physical document. This is simply to tweak the primary concerns that the state had in their recommendations on how to kind of punch it up. So,
okay.
We already have the document, so they're not writing the document.
Okay. All right, so... They're looking for authorization on the amount. Actually, it is within the amount of money that you have been allocated for this activity. So the resolution is for me to sign the document.
Make a motion that we give the give the mayor the authority to enter into the service agreement discussed.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Eldridge.
Thank you.
Land Use Committee.
No. We are fully fleshed out now with all members.
Yeah.
We will meet in October. Everybody has the land use plan, the existing 2006 document. Everyone is going to pick five areas they feel that needs updating. Then we will collaborate on that, and that will determine kind of our next step forward.
Okay.
And we will begin to place a hierarchy on what everybody sees.
And a significant nod to staff that found a Word doc version of that comprehensive plan instead of trying to reformat a PDF.
Yes.
All right. Good job,
it's
staff.
It's expensive.
Stormwater Committee.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, apologize. So we've met. We're continuing to meet to work on getting all the permit requirements for the various sub-permits. for the town to put in as part of the stormwater audit. When we get to department head business, Jimmy will talk about where we are in responding to the state.
Okay.
We'll meet again next week and in person, which will be a lot nicer, I think.
Okay, moving on to department head business administration.
I don't have anything for tonight.
Building inspections department.
John has no updates.
Finance department.
Nothing for tonight.
Fire department. Chief Kennedy.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Council. As you all know, lifeguard season has officially ended on Labor Day. You may see a couple, one or two lifeguards patrol the beach on the weekends, depending on if the weather and swell lines up together to provide some high risk for current days. We have had 2 days that we've used two lifeguards so far, between the hours of 10 and 5. Just like this past weekend, we did not use them because although it was really rough out there, it was extremely rough, so it didn't quite line up with beautiful weather for people to get in. So we'll monitor that. If you do see lifeguards, it'll just be a couple days here and there, depending on the risk of recurrence. Next, we've got fire prevention weeks coming up, October 4th through the 9th, I believe, is the dates. We had originally planned, just like last year, to do an open house. We're going to have a bouncy house for the kids, cook hot dogs, give out smoke detectors, and due to COVID, we're kind of unsure of where we'll be at with the phase, so we're going to postpone that for now. But what we are going to do is I'll get up with Mandy. We're going to try to do a really big push for anyone that needs smoke detectors can call the fire station and get a free smoke detector. We've got quite a few of them in the back. Our crews will also go out into the public and install them for you as well. So I'll make sure to get that message out, whether it be through the news, an email blast, and we'll get it up on the website and on our Facebook page as well, so that way we can continue to support Fire Prevention Week. And then lastly, I sent an email to all of council. We have two firefighters that have been recognized as line of duty guests in the state of North Carolina. Normally what happens is the Fallen Firefighters Foundation they do a big event in May in Raleigh, and they do a parade, and we'll bring a fire engine up there and support that, as well as the family members. This year it was canceled due to COVID, so they have postponed that to originally September, then October, and then now it's postponed to next May in Raleigh, as long as things go well. And then secondly, on top of that, at the national level, the Fallen Firefighters Foundation does an event the first Saturday right before Fire Prevention Week. And they bring in different states, and they will recognize you in Emmitsburg, Maryland, at the National Fire Academy. This year, they had also canceled that, so on Sunday, October 4th, they will be hosting a virtual recognition of one of our members, Dennis Ebersole, at 10 a.m. They have also requested that the fire departments around the area shine a red light in support of those members on the building. I'll get up with someone and try to get some lights on the outside of the building. But if you see red lights on the building for the entire week of Fire Prevention Week, that's exactly what it's for. So if anyone has any questions, please ask. As long as council supports that, I'll continue on trying to find those lights.
That's for Captain Ebersole?
Yes, sir, yes.
And what about our second?
Chief Hagler will be recognized. It's a year behind, so he'll be recognized in the following year. So actually, next year in May, in North Carolina and Raleigh, I believe at this time that they will both be recognized at the same time. Chief Hagler will not be recognized at the national level until next October.
Until next year. Okay. Okay. Do you need anything from us, Ed, or was that just information?
I believe Commissioner Hagler was going to speak with you about working with some opportunities or local churches maybe to...
Yeah, so I just wanted to ask, since this happens before our next meeting and I haven't had a chance, this just came out today, to talk to Dennis's widow. I'd like council permission to work with her if she asks for something from the town. of course, reach out to council for approval. 10 a.m. on Sunday, it could be support with their church, potentially, you know, if we help them get a TV so they can watch it at the church, or if they wanted to watch it at a town building. We'll see what she would like to do, if she'd like to do something like that. I don't think, she may not be interested, but I had a chance to talk to her yet. If she does ask for something, I'll reach out to council for approval. But I'd like permission to at least extend that offer to her and see what she would like to do, if she'd like to do anything. So I'm looking for council consensus, I guess, at this point. And then I'll formally request, if she has a request.
John?
Yeah, I'm totally fine with that.
Absolutely.
Yes. Of course.
Okay. You have council consensus.
Yeah, I'll let you guys know this week once I hear it.
All right.
And then I also would like council permission to have Mandy put the link up on the town website so that any of our citizens that would like to watch it 10 a.m. on October the 4th can watch the virtual recognition for our firefighter.
It's a great idea. John?
Sure. I know that a lot of churches have 10 o'clock on Sunday morning for their virtual churches. So
typically it's recorded so you can watch it afterwards. Yeah. So they'll have the live, and then at least the previous ones have been where you could go back and look at it. So I'm assuming they'll be like that as well.
And someone send me the link.
We will. We'll get that to you.
Yep.
YouTube, Facebook.
There's no limit as how many folks can get on at one time, is there?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm sure they figured that out.
Alan?
I'm fine with it, yeah.
Joseph?
Good.
All right. Let's do that.
Sure.
I have nothing else for the fire department unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Police department?
Nothing till new business.
Sorry?
Nothing till new business.
Okay. Public Works. Long day, Jimmy.
First of all, I don't know if there was any questions or remarks about the monthly report from Public Works.
No, it was fine.
Okay. All right. First thing I would like to discuss was, I don't know if any of you all know that we have an in-ground storage tank at the village lift station that holds our diesel fuel for our emergency backup generator. Okay, we got dinged on that by the state and EPA back in June, and I've been working with the state on this, and this COVID crap just totally took over. But I had a company come out last Tuesday and look at all the recommendations that the state was, well, the requirements that the state was asking from us. And naturally, of course, nothing ever works out like the plan, but the first thing I would want to bring up is, well, the first thing they brought up was that the tank is not any way in compliance due that it's not a dual wall tank. This tank was put in 1987, I do believe, and now the EPA is just totally all over. All right, like I said, I had this company come out and I was going to install an above ground tank. All right, this turned into a very costly expense. They gave me a price of like $98,000 to dig out the tank and put a new tank in. My suggestion, and which I'm trying to work with EWE and all, as far as putting in a new generator with a fuel tank in it so we can eliminate the in-ground storage tank. I'll have more on that next council meeting, but like I said, it's just basically popped up like over a week or so ago. So I wanted to bring it to council's attention. The next thing would be Public Works is finishing up our sewer cleaning requirement of 7,800 annually footage this week. And also in the next 2 weeks, we'll be closing portions of the walkway, basically around the 200 and 300 block for maintenance and repair of the walkways down there. Last but not least, and that's probably going to take around probably 2 weeks or so. So we'll be having portions of it closed off at times. But the main thing is that we did get our stormwater management plan into the state on our September the 10th deadline. We haven't heard back from the state yet on this approval, but I'm sure we will pretty soon. Other than that, I think that's pretty much wraps it up for this afternoon. I mean, if you guys have got any questions, if I can answer it this afternoon, I will.
Well, Jimmy, I know that you're working on a solution that does not involve $99,000 for a tank.
So, no, sir.
And I know you're not ready to bring it forward yet, but I am definitely on that path with you.
But you are going to have to remove that old tank.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely got to come.
Yeah, that has to go.
First thing the company even said. There was no need to even try to fix any of the deficiencies that the tank had. So.
Mandy, we're going to have to...
We're
going to have to put out something on the system, let people know that we're going to be working down there for 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, it'd be probably in 2 weeks that we'll actually start working. So I'll
yeah, just let her know because people walk that every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay. Any questions for Jimmy?
No.
So just for council, once the state approves the proposed plan, there'll be some changes to the stormwater ordinance? We're waiting to see if they approve them before we recommend them. So, and if you'd like the presented plan, we can get Robin to send it out to everyone on council. Basically, it's addressing the deficiencies that were identified in the December audit.
So I'd like to see that.
Okay.
We'll make sure it gets sent out to everyone. We thought we got it out earlier this week, but we obviously did not. So we'll take care of that.
Okay. Thank you. Our recreation department, Nikki?
No items tonight.
Okay, everything was on the consent agenda. All right, thank you. LDSI update?
Okay, so we'll see how PowerPoint worked for me since that worked for a few other people. Basically, the LDSI report has been out and we've had some comments from citizens, which I'm not gonna go through in tonight's presentation, but I will share those with council. Specifically, one of the homeowners association has some pretty specific questions that were for the LDSI, which is good. That's why you let people review the presentation. This PowerPoint is just to talk about the five specific recommendations in there and where we are. So you'll just go to the next slide. So in the report, LDSI identified five specific trauma points in the system, and then we're going to go through all five and recommend what Public Works recommends to council as far as addressing these, and a little more information on the next slide. So the first one was in the area on K Avenue. So that's K Avenue going left to right, sort of, and then Fifth. And basically what you're seeing there is you have 15-inch pipes and an 18-inch pipe coming to a 12-inch pipe. The model, however, for this runoff area shows no issues being surcharged. So even though it necks down, if you're a hydraulic engineer, you'd say this is a bad thing, because it is technically. But if all those pipes, they have to get full before the 12-inch has a problem. The model shows that even in the 25-year storm, that doesn't happen. Additionally, looking back through the past from Public Works, this is not an area where we've had problems. So if you think about the worst flooding in town, it doesn't happen on K Avenue up by Fifth Avenue.
Okay.
That's mostly because you're on a big hill and it runs downhill, but the stormwater system can handle the water in that area. So really the only recommendation from this is just to identify the exact change in location. They only went to all the openings, so they did not go through the pipe, so they cannot identify exactly where that change happens. We have a camera, so we'll identify the actual change for our records and then verify we have no obstructions.
Okay.
So the second area, sorry, I have to look. The second area is right outside of Town Hall. So this is where this is talking about the fact that all these large pipes come together and then discharge right over to the ditch on K Avenue with a 30-inch pipe. And we're going to see In the next slide, actual that pipe during a high loading event. But the recommendation is just to manage any changes with the beach walk pond feeding into this. So as long as there's no changes upstream, this system has no problems. So the model shows that it doesn't have problems, and then during actual events, we haven't had problems at that ditch. And if we go to the next slide, once we get there, first click on the one on the left. So this is looking from that ditch towards the fire station. So that's my car sitting right by the fire station up in the top of that. If it will play, there we go. Yeah. This is on August 20th when we had a large rain event early that morning, and we're going to see on issue 5 upstream of this. But this is showing first that this is only 40% loaded in that large stream event. The one on the right is a little closer show just so you can watch it. You can actually see even in a large event, because we're going to go back upstream and see how loaded everything was, this is only about 30% loaded. So I should have climbed down there and cut all those fronds out of the way so you can really see the pipe better, but that is the full pipe behind the fronds. Just kind of a picture, maybe worth 1,000 words. So again, with the upstream control, not really control, but the upstream pipes being the limiting factor, it never overloads these pipes at the downstream side at K Avenue. You can go to the next slide. And for those on the phone, if you can't get this, this will get put up after the meeting, so I apologize if you're not seeing this the same way we are. You can just, there you go. That's fine.
Take a second to catch up.
Okay, so this is on 4th Avenue, and basically you have an 18-inch pipe drop to a 12-inch pipe and then back to a 15-inch pipe. There's a 75-foot section of this pipe between M, this side of M Avenue. The model does show this is a surcharge condition, and the town has noticed impacts in this area. So the recommendation is to replace this 12-inch pipe with a 15-inch pipe. We have to identify exactly how long that run is. The estimate is 75-foot. So we'll be working on getting prices for that. And then now that we're getting in the off season, get that in to Jimmy's schedule on the plan. That will impact two citizens' yards when we're doing that work. And so we got to coordinate with those citizens as well. We'll get the price estimate. And then as we're working with Arlen on the stormwater fee issue moving forward, this will be one of the projects that will be put in there for that. Next. So this one is beach walk drainage coming right on the just to the east of Town Hall behind the beach walk sign. This is where the two 24-inch pipes that outlet their pond system come into with a 24-inch pipe that services Fifth Street and then goes to the 30-inch pipe which then goes below the town parking lot area for Town Hall. So the model shows the outfall is throttled by the boundary conditions of the ponds. So if you read the report, the issue is the way the ponds work is they control how much water can come through that. We're going to see that in the next slide. Additionally, multiple times, so during Florence, during August 20th, which is the picture that I'm getting ready to show you, and then during other flooding events, I've been out there personally and walked those pipes just to watch what's happening, and that's why I took pictures August 20th. I had other pictures from this time frame, but in Esaias, I lost my phone due to a water rescue issue, and all the photos were not uploaded like I thought they were to the iCloud. The recommendation really on this is any changes that Beachwalk proposes upstream of this system should be reviewed by an engineer as their impact to this system. So right now we're limited by their input boundary conditions. If they were to change something in their pond system, we need to make sure that the town, before that gets approved, gets an engineer to evaluate it as far as downstream so we don't cause a plugging problem. If we go to the next slide and just click on them. So to the left, this is the actual 30-inch pipe that feeds through to the town. So if you run that one, and you can...
Can I stop you for just a second? I'm getting more messages that we don't have audio. Let me check
okay. I'll stop.
I had one to start with, so I thought it was on there.
Okay, well, it's fair.
Yeah, we're on.
Okay. Can anyone out in phone land hear us, star six, and tell us you can hear us? Since it was reported there were phone issues. How many are still online, does it show?
Three.
Can you text it back? I mean...
Well, no, two.
Two? One of the two people out there, can you tell us you're still online? David Garso, can you hear me? Star six.
Well, he's on his app, so he just needs to unmute himself.
You got to unmute yourself on your app. I love technology. We'll get back to the old way.
We're connected. Nothing's muted. Call's still going.
Do you want to restart it or? You want to tell them to listen to the audio since it's broke?
We should keep moving. It's getting late for staff, so text David and ask him if he would just pick up with the audio.
It's Teams, Microsoft Teams.
I'm just going to recall it. Let me just read out the number.
Okay, that's fine. Boy.
I texted David for a second.
Tell him we're recalling him. So. Oh, man.
It says he cannot cut off.
Okay. Tell him we're...
It's probably a spectrum issue.
Spectrum.
Gotta blame somebody. John Bassett's not
that
here.
That interweb thing.
Yeah. John Bassett's not here, so I got to blame somebody. Bethany, it's your fault, no.
It's the interweb.
Oh, wait, it's our phone.
Oh.
It says no service.
There you go, it says spectrum.
Well, that's good reason. Did we use more time than we're supposed to?
I'm sure we paid over an
hour.
Do we get a new CD for 4 hours? I'm on line with my iPad though. Loading the pages.
You may be on Wi-Fi.
I am, yeah. Oh. Aren't they viable?
Okay, I tell you.
In the viable. We'll see if we don't let you go.
Would you let David know to pick it up?
Maybe. Okay. Well, let him know we have no service.
Yeah,
you call.
Let him know we have.
If you can text the other, well, you can.
She has it.
If you text him, we can call him and.
He just said it cut off.
Can you chat back? We can't chat back.
I have Teams for work.
Is that how you're on the call?
No, I'm not on the call. I just texted him to his cell phone.
Oh, well, can you text him on that we're resetting the phone?
Yeah.
Technology.
Everybody else. So Teams went dead. He tried calling, but that is also silent.
That's
why
the phone is
not
our team. She's hung up, so
we'll refrain. David, what do you want to bring up the LDSI and the pipe issue? They're in this or new business for commissioner items?
When I get finished, that's fine. We can talk about it, we'll talk about it. I mean, if we want a contractor for that, I'm sure they'd be glad to. Well, at least someone told us. Someone was listening.
Hey, Nikki, can you go look at Denise's office and see if her phone says no service?
We're going to council meeting. The conference room, see if that one says. See if it says no service.
I got that out of the work.
Okay.
Long call.
It says no service, but there's a dial tone.
It's just that speaker's not moving.
Oh, really?
Yes, I saw that.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. We have some technical issue. We need to get going.
Yep.
Mandy?
We can record it and just
post it.
We are recording.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I think somebody might be on for parking.
Yeah.
Why is there a car outside that's had his lights on for half an hour?
Mandy, will let him know that.
It was bad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we'll send out a notice on the town website immediately, okay. Too.
All right.
Okay, so due to a technical difficulty with the phone system, we have dropped citizens' input. And because of that, council is being advised that we need to continue the meeting to another day to solve the technical issue. The meeting will stop at the slide issue number 4, continued August 20, 2020, for LDSI report by Commissioner Hegler. Council, do we have a recommended date? I have to go out of town and can't be back until Thursday.
I was going to say Thursday night because of the next two nights.
Yep. So does Thursday night work for the rest of the council?
Can we do it at like 5?
I can't do Thursday night.
Okay. What about Friday?
I can do Friday.
Friday at 4?
As early as you want, Friday. I'll take off. What time do y'all want to do it on Friday?
Let's do it at 3 o'clock Friday. Is that good with our attorney?
I've got a conflict.
General's a conflict.
Okay. How? When's your conflict cleared on Friday?
Monday looks great.
Okay, let me look.
Yes, it doesn't.
Okay, so Monday.
Your Monday doesn't look good.
No,
I do. So
Friday,
we need to
clear up.
If we're going to do it Monday, we need to do it.
5 o'clock Friday works.
Let's do 5 o'clock Friday then. We have about an hour left, it looks like.
Okay, yeah, we don't have that much longer.
Make a motion that we continue this meeting until 5 p.m. Friday, September 25th, due to our technical difficulties.
There's a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion. Meeting.